and good evening, and welcome to Bird Calls, made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. Tonight, we invite you to call in with your questions about our feathered friends and the avian world during the show at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Cliff Shackelford is our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio, and he's ready to answer your questions about birds tonight. Cliff is currently the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, a position he has held since 1997, and he has been an avid bird watcher for more than 30 years. He is also the first author of the book Hummingbirds of Texas, published back in 2005 by Texas A&M University Press, and he has authored more than 70 publications on birds and birding. He and his wife Julie and their two young children live in East Texas. And Cliff, thanks again for joining us tonight.
Hey, Bill. Good fall evening to you.
Yeah, and as we get started, we'll remind folks you can call in during this program at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question regarding birds and our avian world are welcome tonight. And Cliff, let's refresh people about last month's conservation tip.
Okay. Yep. We ended the show with a tip on pest control. We talked about the value of raptors and how if we didn't have all the hawks and other birds of prey around us, we'd be overrun with pesky rodents, pesky insects, and a lot of other things that would just go out of control. So raptors are part of creating balance out there in the natural world. But sometimes we unknowingly harm them or we don't respect them. One way we can harm them is putting out pesticides or baits for rodents. You know, there's no substitute for the good old way of snap traps, or you can go online, and I looked up on YouTube, saw a couple really cool ways to catch and remove rodents from your property. But throwing out poison that a rat might eat or a mouse, and then he's half dead and hobbles outside, and a raptor sees that as easy pickings and eats it. Guess where that poison is? It goes from belly to belly, and that's a big problem. So, and just because you don't see it happen doesn't mean it's not happening. So there are declines in a lot of our raptors, and that's one of many reasons why. But it's we've got to remember that we need raptors around us. We shouldn't be terrified every time we see a hawk or an eagle. That we need to realize that they have a role too. They're filling a niche and they're doing a good job at it.
Everything is a part of a web, literally, and you cut one string and something falls apart on the web.
It's important to realize it that you know, we need them around us. They're working for us for free as natural pest control agents, and they belong as a good neighbor.
Sort of like a knit sweater. You cut one string and look to what happens. It all starts to fall apart.
That's right.
Well, give us a call, folks. This is Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. The number to call is 800-552-8502. Again, that's 800-552-8502. And this month, what is our bird spotlight going to be?
Well, we profiled last month the red-tailed hawk. That one tied into the pest control that we just mentioned. This episode, we're going to talk about vultures, the black and turkey vulture. We're going to profile a duo. We've never done a duo of species that look pretty similar and have somewhat similar roles. I thought it was just going to be easier to lump them together and profile the duo of black and turkey vultures. So we have two species of vultures in our listening area and the entire southeastern U.S. Their names, again, are black vulture and turkey vulture, and they often occur together. They're not very vocal, so we don't have any recordings to play tonight. At the most, you'll hear some deep grunts or occasional barks, plus, of course, loud swishing wing beat sounds when they take flight. When young or disturbed at the nest, they'll hiss loudly in an attempt to scare you away, and it usually works. You'll hear them shh, shh. If you come across a nest in, say, an old barn. A commonly used colloquial name for both these vultures is buzzard. But that's an incorrect holdout that English settlers brought with them to the U.S. centuries ago. The soaring vultures here in the U.S. reminded them of buzzards back home, yet buzzards in England and Europe are hawks in the genus Butio, which are very similar to our red-tailed hawk and not vultures. Vultures have weak feet. They're not designed to seize or carry off prey. That's why they're often in the middle of the road munching on recent roadkill. They're also attracted to landfills and dumpsters for obvious reasons. Flapping wings in flight takes a lot of calories, especially for a large bird like a vulture, so it's easier to soar on their 5 to 6 foot wingspan, especially using swirling thermals from the sun warming the earth. So weighing at about 4.5 pounds, a vulture is a master of soaring, and they're our environmental cleanup crew. To find food, turkey vultures use olfaction. That's the sense of smell, but black vultures have a poor sense of smell and use sight instead. Sight to see the food or sight to cheat a little bit and see where the turkey vultures are circling because they often find the food first. Vultures nest in hollow trees, abandoned buildings like the old barn I mentioned earlier, caves, stumps, or the limy crown of a recent tree fall. The two species are roughly the same size, but if you look closely, there are some noticeable differences in the head color, the silvery lining in the wing while in flight, and the way they hold their wings while soaring. Here are some of the things to look for. The one that's overall feather color is more of a dark chocolate is the black vulture, while the one that's more of a milk chocolate is the turkey vulture. And you can really see that when they're sitting together on a pole or wire or tower. The adult with the gray featherless head is the black vulture, while the one with the red featherless head is the turkey vulture. The one with the silvery lining only at the tips of the open wing is the black vulture, while the one with the silvery lining extending across the entire trailing edge of the open wing is the turkey vulture. And we have that picture online that we borrowed from Wikipedia. And we also have a picture from James Childress of the black vulture. So I encourage you to go to our website at redriverradio.com and look for .org, isn't it? And one final thing about vultures, to tell them apart, the one soaring with wings held fairly flat on the horizontal is the black vulture, while the one soaring with wings tilted upward slightly is the turkey vulture. So those tilted wings are referred to as dihedral. That's possibly the word for the day for some listeners. And this refers to the V shape of their wings in flight, which means they hold their wings slightly above the horizontal. So we had some cool words of the day. The dihedral might be a new one. There was another one. Which one did I say that was not a commonly used term? And I've forgotten which one I said. Oh, olfaction. O-L-F-A-C-T-I-O-N. The sense of smell. So that's not a word we all often hear, but maybe those two words will help you in a future crossword puzzle. How about that?
There you go. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. Our phone lines are open right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question about birds or our avian world are welcome tonight. Again, 800-552-8502. And we do have our first caller online, Jason from Longview. You're on with Cliff Shackelford. What's your question tonight?
Hi, I have a question about owls.
Okay.
I live in a fairly standard neighborhood surrounded by other neighborhoods, and there are a few groves of trees around. And occasionally, we go out most every morning to take the dog out and things like that before it's light. And we will hear 2 to 3 owls. I'm not sure what kind they are. Mm-hmm. I should know by now as much as I've listened to this show, but they kind of make a hoo, 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 hoo sound. Yeah. And I'm just wondering, it's very intermittent when we hear them.
Right.
We might hear them once a month. We might hear them, you know, twice in a given week. It doesn't seem consistent at all. And what I'm wondering is, do owls tend to establish, or do
Whoa.
They move through it?
We're gonna go ahead and answer your question. I don't know what happened there, but go ahead and
okay.
pick up that question.
I think we heard enough of the question. Sorry, Jason, we had technical difficulty here and got you cut off. But the owl you described and imitated sounded sure like a great horned owl, and they sort of sound like woo-hoo-hoo, woo-hoo, very deep. But the intermittency of it is that a lot of these birds have seasons. And so in the nesting and the pre-nesting season, birds are a lot more vocal, you know, because hormones are flowing. They're trying to attract a mate. If they have a mate, they're trying to keep the mate. But there's parts of the year where these birds are very quiet, yet they're still there. And also another thing to consider is in a neighborhood, you probably have to have a giant property, the owl's property, his territory, his and hers territory is going to be pretty big, because you got to think about the rooftop and the swimming pools and the roads that really take that habitat out of commission. There's not too much going on there, although you do see owls foraging along roadsides a lot, and that's not very healthy, as we see a lot of owls get hit by cars for doing that. So in summary, again, Jason, great horned owl, large territory, and seasonal use of that song. It's not going to necessarily be a daily thing, but it's really going to accelerate in the pre-breeding season and then through the breeding season. So
you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. You are on the air with Cliff. What's your question tonight?
Yeah, I came in 2 or 3 minutes late, and I hope this is not redundant. You were describing the disparities between the turkey and the black vulture.
Uh-huh.
I grew up around here in East Texas, and I've watched these birds my whole life. In the last several, I can't recall how many, but the last few years, I don't see hardly any turkey vultures, but I'm seeing a lot of black vultures where I don't recall seeing those in the past. Is there something going on there, or am I just not paying as close attention as I once did?
Well, black vultures are certainly on the increase, and so you're probably seeing more of those than you would have 30, 40 years ago. And I think turkey vultures are holding their own, but they're also more migratory. Turkey vultures tend to get out of Dodge in the colder months. We still have some, don't get me wrong. But we see a lot of them pass through that are from the farther north than us and come through our area to get to warmer climates in the wintertime. So it could be, yes, you're seeing the increase in black vultures. They're becoming very habituated to urban living. You'll see them more in cities, like I mentioned, landfills and dumpsters. Roadways are really important for them. They're cleaning our roads. That's not really healthy either. You don't want to spend a lot of time on the road. So where are you calling from?
The Longview area. Okay. South of Longview.
Okay, JC. Yeah. So I think you're seeing those kinds of things. What else have you noticed about changes that you've seen?
All of a sudden it seemed like could have occurred when I wasn't paying attention.
Yeah.
Concern, you know, with all the problems we're having with other things, honeybees. I mean, if the vultures start dying out from something, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, we need those scavengers, don't we?
Waist deep is what I've always heard. we'd be in Offal if it wasn't for them.
That's right. Oh, yeah, that's right. And we're going to talk more about that at the conservation tip at the end. So.
Okay.
All right. Thanks for the call, JC.
You bet.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We have another caller online. Again, I do not have the name right now. They're having some trouble back in the phone room, but we'll go ahead and take this call. What's your name, please?
This is Stacy Stroud. I'm from North Central Louisiana.
Hi, Stacy.
Hello. I was wanting to take advantage of bat guano for in my garden. I do live in a reclaimed pasture, and it's to nest in this area.
To get bats to nest, you know, to get guano that you can harvest, you have to have hundreds of thousands of bats, and we just don't have that. That's not part of our area here in the Piney Woods. The places where they get in massive congregations in Central Texas, for example, is where bats, you can have just giant piles where you can actually harvest it. So I think that's probably not a good goal or objective to have for our area. So I think you're lucky to get, you know, maybe 15 or 20 in a roost site. But again, it's if you've ever gone to Bracken Cave, or the one that most people go to is this Congress Street Bridge in Austin, Texas. Bracken Cave is kind of between New Braunfels and San Antonio. These are places where there's jillions of bats. So Bracken Cave has about 20 million bats. That's a lot of poop. And they're all, yep, they're all going into one cave. They the bats are real specific on their climate. They have to have the humidity just right. It has to, of course, be dark. And there's not a whole lot of these kinds of places. But the Congress Street Bridge in Austin that goes over the Colorado River there, what we call, used to be called Town Lake. It's now called Lake Lady Bird. But that's another place where you have jillions of bats, and guano can really pile up. Unfortunately, they can't harvest it because a lot of it's falling in the river because they're roosting in these slits underneath the bridge, and it goes into the river. So, this is a bird show. I do know just enough about bats to answer your question that I would find another objective than that.
All right. Thanks so much. Yep. Have a great evening.
You bet. Thanks.
Thank you. And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. Any question regarding our avian world is welcome. That's 800-552-8502. We go next to Mary from Kichai. Mary, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
Hi. Well, I have about a 3-acre pond on my place, and I've got 3 wood duck boxes. And every year I've had wood ducks nesting in the boxes. But for the last 2 or 3 years, the wood ducks come and then they just leave. And I'm just wondering if there's something going on with wood ducks that I don't know about.
Well, and how certain are you that they're not nesting? Because wood ducks can be very secretive.
Well, yes, but I check the boxes.
And
sometimes there's snakes in them, you know, but really I don't think they've been nesting, and they just don't stay long enough.
And do you clean the boxes out? Because what wood ducks will do is they'll pluck feathers, put it in there, and when they leave for whatever time period, when the nest is unattended, they'll cover the nest up, the eggs up with their loose feathers. And so you'll look in and go, I don't see any eggs. Well, they're hidden. They're under just a thin layer of feathers. So are you seeing that by chance?
No, I don't think so. I just don't think they've been staying at my pond. I watch them carefully. I live right there on the water, so I would see them if they were here.
Yeah, and I don't know how wood ducks make it. If you ever see the babies, the nestlings fledge and get on the water, it's a race. I mean, the rest of their life is a race, but especially while they're little, because there's bass and turtles and herons that are just loving these new little tender victuals that are coming out that they can eat on. And then the mom takes them and hauls them off, and now they're on foot trying to walk from your pond to maybe a more permanent waterway. Well, they've got to cross roads sometimes or thickets. There might be feral cats, bobcats, foxes. I mean, it's just amazing that wood ducks even can reproduce if you think about it. So I don't know. Maybe has anything changed vegetationally around your pond?
No, there's a little more activity here now, I think, than there was.
Because if they don't have that clear runway to get them out of there, because you'll find that when they fledge, they won't spend but minutes at that pond. They won't spend the rest of their lives there. So people that want to have wood ducks and have babies and see them every day, that's not going to happen on an ag farm, on a typical stock pond like what it sounds like you have. So
it could be just that there's a little more activity in my house.
It could be,
But it's not much more. I really can't see much difference. I'm just wondering if there's a lower population of wood ducks in our area.
Yeah, no, I think wood ducks are doing fairly well. It's really helped that people like you are putting out nest boxes, because this is a species of duck that used to nest in old cavities. It still does. But things like what a pileated woodpecker might leave behind and abandon the next year, a wood duck will take to it, or an old limb that falls off and there's wood rot into the tree and creates a cavity. That's what wood ducks like.
Well, I have a lot of old growth and old trees and dead trees on my property. Maybe they just prefer that.
It could be that they like that, and because they don't have to nest over water. And you'll see a lot of cavities, natural cavities, not in anywhere near water where wood ducks are nesting, and it's you know, can be 60 feet up. I've seen especially video of the young ones jumping out. You know, they're only a day or two old, and they bounce like ping pong balls after they've dropped that far. It's just amazing how this little guy can make it. So, but no,
I'll be sure to clean them out really well this year, and maybe they'll come back.
Okay, sounds good, Mary.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mary. And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. We have lines open right now. You can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question regarding birds or our avian world are welcome. We go next to Walter from Hallsville, Texas. Walter, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
Well, first, thank you for doing the show, Cliff.
Great, thanks.
And I found a hawkwing out on the highway.
Okay.
And I wanted to let know everybody, leave it there.
Right.
Because if they catch you with that hawkwing, they're going to charge you a fine.
Yep. Walter, I appreciate you reminding listeners that, because part of my job is to identify bird parts that mm-hmm. people like to keep and maybe hang from their rearview mirror. Put in their hat. And so I've had to identify talons of raptors that people cut off, and they promised the game warden that they found it dead on the road. Well, you can't prove it. So you're right. The best thing to do is leave it. Don't mess with it. Yep. Don't pick it up.
Yep.
And we now have game wardens that troll the internet because people are always bragging about these things that they've done. And look at this hawk I shot. And, you know, it sure helps when we can find them on the internet. So bird parts are protected, and that includes feathers. And so you're totally right, Walter.
Yeah, it's hard.
That's right.
I've also got a question. You know, the white-nosed fungus on the bat, how are they coming with that?
It's no good. It's not good. It's moving southward. It's been detected in Texas. It's going to be more of an issue in colder climate. I don't know much more about it, but it's not good for bats.
No, it's not.
Yeah.
We're putting so much pollution in the atmosphere right now. It's Mother Nature's on the run.
That's right. That's right.
And man's killing it.
Right. Good. Good
they
point.
They don't care.
Yep.
They're all out for that almighty dollar. And if you can't breathe the air, what good's the dollar?
That's right. That's right. Good point. So, all right, Walter, we appreciate your call. Thank you.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call right now about any question regarding our avian world at 800-552-8502. I didn't quite catch, was he talking about a mold on bats or what was?
Yeah, white nose syndrome. It's a fungus, and it's super toxic, and it hits these colonies. I mentioned that these, you know, many, many bats, many species across the country will roost and nest communally, and that's a problem if there's a disease, because it can spread.
Right.
You know, in the human world, we have things like bacterial meningitis that, you know, if you're at a military base or a school, it can just spread like wildfire. Well, this is a deadly event for bats. It's called white nose syndrome, and I encourage people to look it up. You know, I don't know a whole lot about it. It's a bat. That's a mammal, and that's maybe on the next show if we get a mammal show.
A conservation tip for the next show.
Yeah.
Well, you are listening to Bird Calls. We have phone lines open. The number is 800-552-8502, and we go next to John from Shreveport. John, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
How you doing? I enjoy your program.
Hey, great. Thanks, John.
I office in a high building in downtown Shreveport, and we have a ledge around the top floor of the building, mm-hmm. and the turkey buzzards and the black buzzards love to come to that ledge. And for 2 or 3 years, we had a great number of turkey buzzard visitors, infrequent black buzzards. But the building owner got upset about that. As I understand it, he contacted Barksdale, which is always aware of birds for the airplanes,
mm-hmm.
and they tell me several frozen dead turkey buzzards and put them on top of the building,
mm-hmm.
and we haven't seen a turkey buzzard since. The black buzzards still come back from time to time, but those red turkey buzzards were always intriguing to our visitors because they'd walk right up to the window. And, but for the window pane, you could have grabbed them on the nose.
Yeah, and they're seeing a reflection.
Yeah.
They don't see through the window, so they saw, you know, blue sky and pretty white clouds and such, obviously. And those guys are loafing. They're filling up on the roadside of roadkill, and then they've got to go find a place to just hang out. And when you're a big bird like that, like a B-52 bomber, it makes sense when you're a soaring bird just to soar into a high perch. That's why your building high-rise is important, or before humans, big, tall, dead trees were really good because you didn't have a whole lot of limbs on it, so they wouldn't crash land. But you'll see them using cell towers and big KV electric lines and so forth. These man-made structures really make it easy for a big bird to soar in and out. So I would think that the building manager maybe had trouble with the whitewash. That's usually the complaint that would be had with something like that if they are up there in numbers and they're pooping everywhere. Here's we're talking about poop again. We had the guano call, and now the vulture poop. That's good theme today.
Yeah, they ate the insulation, the rubber insulation.
Yeah,
all.
Yeah, and that's another thing that loafing vultures do is they have time on their hands, and they kind of act like bored teenagers. And so we get a lot of calls, especially from boat ramps, on the edge of lakes and reservoirs, where people will park their boat and trailer and go out. They put their boat in the water and go out and leave, and they go fishing. And they come back, and the vultures have loafed on the truck. And they've pulled up the gasket around the windshield. They've torn up the windshield wipers. They're really intrigued with the black rubber of gaskets and windshield wipers, and they just start creating a mess.
Do you believe the carcasses are what shat them away?
I don't know. What's that word? Sarcophagus? Is that the word?
Yeah.
That's another good word for the day. I don't know. I mean, clearly it sounded like it worked. I mean, to test it, you would, you know, of course, want to have a control. You'd want to have a different roost where you didn't do that and see if, because you could rule out what I mentioned earlier about migration. So it could be that some of those birds left. I mean, but we don't have, in our listening area, we don't have a period where vultures completely leave. We're mild here.
You can still see them, you know, in the area, yeah, but they just never come back.
Right. So. But southern Canada, where turkey vultures are, it's bloody cold. Black vultures up farther north, they got to get out of there. I mean, I think about the roadkill that never thaws out for 3 months. How are they going to eat?
Right.
We don't have vulture-free periods, so I don't know, to answer your question, I don't know if that worked, but I have heard that used before. I've heard people do that with crows as well. And so, you know, if you have a problem with crows at your pecan orchard, that's one method people use. But I don't know. Vultures are not as clever as crows. I would think a crow would figure it out pretty soon, but there's no shortage of these tall man-made structures that I mentioned where vultures can go. So your building manager probably scared them away like a tennis match, and the ball went to another court. Someone else probably had the luxury of having those birds.
Well, thanks for your time.
Yeah, thank you, John.
Thank you, John. And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call at 800-552-8502. And we have David online on hold. David, please stick with us. Rick from Boise, Idaho, you're next. What's your question, Rick?
Hi, yes. We live right on the Snake River, just outside of Boise, Idaho.
Mm-hmm.
And we have two wood duck boxes and a kestrel box.
Oh, cool.
And we have wood ducks all over the place. The kestrels have kind of left.
Mm-hmm.
But the wood ducks are laying eggs. We've never seen a baby come, mm-hmm, a hatchling.
Mm-hmm.
And every fall, I clean out the boxes, and there'll be two and a half dozen eggs in each box.
And they've never hatched, huh?
And they never hatched.
Okay. Well, I don't know much about the wood ducks in Boise, and actually, you're going to certainly be our first caller from Idaho, so that's pretty cool. We're excited to have you calling us down here in Louisiana, Rick. But the kestrels, what's really neat is you're probably producing kestrels that come down to see us. So we have your birds wintering with us down here in the south. So that's pretty neat. We do have kestrels that breed in small numbers in the listening area, in open longleaf, for example. But the majority of our kestrels come to us in the fall, like this month in October, and they bred points farther to the north. So kudos for breeding kestrels, because that's a good one to have. And I don't know what to tell you about your wood ducks. It could be that these are just not fertilized eggs, and that you have a female and she's got to get rid of the eggs, but she's moving on. I don't know.
We have a passel of both sexes.
Okay.
And they're just all over. We'll have almost two dozen on the lawn at a time.
Yeah. And are wood ducks supposed to be on the Snake River? I'm trying to think of my Idaho bird life, and I don't know if that's a recent thing.
Well, I don't know if they're supposed to be there, but they're there.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm just thinking if it's a new thing, if they've moved up in there recently and if that's a new thing or not. But I don't know my Idaho birds as well as I should. But anyway, well, thanks for the call, Rick, and keep producing those kestrels, because we love them. Send them our way, and we'll take care of them in the winter.
They're a delightful bird.
Very good.
We will do.
Cool.
Thank you.
Yeah,
bye.
So I was wondering if it could be some kind of an environmental factor up there that causes the eggs to be stillborn or not.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, the only way to do it is have an expert test the eggs and figure out. I mean, the first thing you would do is what any chicken farmer would do, is look to see if they're fertile.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and you don't want to really do that when birds are nesting. And technically, you're not supposed to do that. You're not supposed to mess with eggs. But I don't know if he goes back weeks later, if how that works.
Right.
I think that the best we can do is keep these boxes clean. So hopefully, Rick, if you're still listening, and others with wood duck boxes, clean them out in the off season. Part of nesting for birds is to reinitiate the nest, and that means bringing in fresh litter, grasses, leaves, and leaving their own feathers, because some of these nests can be just overrun with nest mites.
Right.
And so cleaning it out is a good idea. And also that stuff that I mentioned, you know, leaves and grass and feathers, they can get pretty mushy and
moldy
and nasty. I mean, it just makes sense to clean it out. And that's part of the pair bonding is them bringing in nests that, you know, they're not looking for free government housing all the time. Right. I mean, they get it in the box itself, but let them do part of the nest building, and that is to create the actual cushiony part where they put the eggs.
So it's habitat for avianity.
Yeah, very good.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We go next to David from Simpson, Louisiana. David, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
Hello. I do research with ticks and mammals. I was wondering if there was any vector-borne diseases for birds that are transmitted by ticks in the area that you know of.
I mean, all we hear about are different species of mosquitoes with West Nile virus. But no, I don't think I've ever heard of anything, but this is not my specialty. But I can't think of anything. I would think a quick Google search would probably lead you in the direction you want to go. But off the top of my head, you know, the things we hear about that are transmitted are going to be by mosquito, typically.
Okay.
Yeah.
Has there been anything recently where there's been some data about West Nile in the area?
Well, you know, West Nile, it's been around since about 1999, I think, is when the first case hit in the northeast New York area, and then it swept through, and it didn't take long to go coast to coast. And so there's a lot of stuff out there. But I'm not keeping up with that kind of literature. That's usually more of a health and human services type of publication. And those kinds of things are typically not found in my ornithological journals that I read.
However, they might be found with Dr. Beverly Burton if she has to be listening.
That could be a call for the next What's Bugging You.
Yeah,
maybe.
Which is next Tuesday night.
Yeah.
So
and I'll be listening.
Yeah, and give her a call. And if she's listening, she has plenty of time to look this up and be prepared. But I don't have anything for you, David, other than mosquitoes are probably going to be the dominant by far for birds. Okay.
Okay. Well, thank you for your time. Have a good night.
Thank you.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We go next to Leon from Bossier City. Leon, you're on question with, or you're on line with Cliff. What's your question?
Just an observation.
Okay.
Going north on Airline Drive, once you get out of Bossier City, before you get to Benton, the high lines are, in the fall, have a whole bunch of hawks on them.
Hmm.
I saw the first one yesterday.
Okay.
And a week or two from now, there will be 10 or 15 of them.
Okay.
And I just wondered, is that the migratory thing from the hawks that come down?
Now, are you talking about the 10 or 15 are almost hugging shoulder to shoulder? Or are you talking about you're driving 20 miles and there's one every couple miles or every half mile? What are we talking about?
No, within a mile or so, there'll be 10 or 15.
Okay, but they're not shoulder to shoulder, right? Because I can't think
not shoulder to shoulder.
Yeah, I can't think of any hawks that are going to do that. Sitting on wire shoulder to shoulder and that kind of grouping, I just don't think of that. But I think maybe what you're seeing, are we talking about the big chunky hawks maybe, like red-tailed hawk? They will be pushing out of the north coming through here. That maybe is what you're seeing because I certainly – you know, I-20, for example, and I mentioned this in the last episode, because we profiled the red-tailed hawk, that if you drove from Shreveport to Dallas in the dead of winter, you'd see a whole lot of red-tailed hawks wintering along that stretch of road. They're up on posts, high lines, wires, looking for rodents that are in that grassy, weedy roadside edge. And so I'm guessing that's what we're talking about here as well, Leon. Does that sound plausible?
I'll bet you're right.
Yeah. But that is going to be, you asked if it's related to migration. The answer is yes, because when it's time to breed, most of these hawks will get out into their own little territory. They're very defensive. They've got to protect amount of space that they can feed their mouths and the nestlings' mouths. So they get very territorial. So you wouldn't see that I can't think of any raptor that's going to be in the breeding season a communal thing, you know, except for maybe like the grand exception is going to be a Harris hawk out in West Texas and South Texas that occur in sometimes what we call family groups, extended family groups, but it's just maybe five or six birds tops. So, yeah. But I'm guessing you're seeing wintering red tails coming to our area.
And when they winter here, are they breeding here as well?
No, when you're seeing big numbers like that, these are birds that probably, if they're red tails, they were in Alberta, Saskatchewan, the Great Lakes, the Northern Great Plains, the Dakotas, and they're all retreating that cold, what's about to be super cold and difficult to find food, and they come down to warmer climate. So these are not local breeders, no.
Mm.
Yeah, pretty amazing. And some of the raptors that especially go through parts farther west of the listening area in central Texas, we have the corridor of central Texas are where Swainson's hawks pour through, and they're Great Plains nesters, Southern Canada nesters, and they go all the way to Argentina, which is remarkable.
Wow.
And so they aren't going to cross water, so the Gulf of Mexico is a big obstacle, so they typically stay west of the Gulf of Mexico. They're going to go funnel through the coast of Mexico. There's a pinching point in Veracruz where if you look up the term River of Raptors, there's a geographic pinching point where raptors can't fly to the east of because it's the Gulf of Mexico, and the west of is the Rocky or the Sierra Madres, the mountains. So there's a narrow strip that's maybe, I don't know, 50 miles or less wide, and you can stand there and see kajillion raptors. But that's Veracruz, Mexico, not in the U.S.
Oh, interesting.
Yep.
Wow.
But it's amazing. Swainson's hawks are, you know, might be breeding in southern Canada and spending the winter in Argentina, and they might live 12, 15 years or more and do this migration every year. I mean, it's just remarkable to me that, you know, here I've got to get on an airplane, rent a car, and do all this other stuff and cheat. And they're doing it on their own. And a lot of these Swainson's hawks are eating large arthropods, a lot of grasshoppers. And it's just amazing to me that they're fueling it, the trip on their own.
Wow.
Yep.
Yes.
So,
it's
yeah.
Fascinating.
It is fascinating. And the little songbirds, I mean, the hummingbirds, I mean, it's just amazing that a ruby-throated hummingbird can go all the way up to Minnesota and in the winter is in southern Mexico, and that bird might live 8 or 10 years. And you know, despite what our grandparents told us that they ride on the backs of geese, that's bogus. It's not true. They're powering their own flight, and it's just remarkable that they can do it. So migration, once you start looking into migration, Leon, you will be amazed. And not just birds, but I think it's just amazing about dragonflies that migrate and butterflies. And there's just a lot of species that make these annual migrations. They've been doing it for millennia, and a lot of us don't see it or don't pay attention to it. But once we start learning about it, it's remarkable. So I think you ought to do some looking online, Leon, for some books on migration. There are several neat books, and I think you'll be really amazed. I have to make a shout out to one book I've read. It's been a while. It's called Living on the Wind. It's by Scott Wiedensahl, and that is absolutely my favorite book that really focuses on migration and really focuses on shorebirds, because they are some of the true long-distance runners in the migration world. So that's my homework assignment to you, Leon, is to find a copy of Living on the Wind by Scott Wiedensahl and read it, and it will change your life.
Okay.
All right.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502 with any question regarding our avian world. We go next to Kelly from Alexandria. Kelly, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
Well, thanks for taking my call, and good evening. About 2 weeks ago, we were driving around Cane River Lake near Natchitoches, and I saw a bird on a wire that I've never seen before. It was shaped, the body was shaped like a mockingbird, but it had a tail that was 2 to 3 times longer than its body.
Uh-huh. How about a scissor tail flycatcher?
Okie dokie.
Is that sound like what it could have been? I mean,
I had no idea.
Yeah.
I was astonished at the length of the tail,
right.
And it was sort of tan in color.
Yep.
White chest.
Yep.
And we were on the motorcycle, so I couldn't point it out to my girlfriend who was on the back, but it was just the tail was incredible.
Yeah,
it was a beautiful bird.
And once you explained how long that tail was, it immediately led me to scissor tail flycatcher, because there's nobody else like that. So when we finish this call, I encourage you to go online when you can and just Google scissor-tailed flycatcher and click images and see if that's your bird, and I bet you it is, because the males have a heck of a long tail. Yeah, and they're a beautiful bird too. That's the state bird of Oklahoma, and you'll see that on their, that's available on their license plates for their conservation plate has a, I don't know if it's their conservation plate, but it's in one of the options of a license plate on your car, which I think is really cool, is a scissor-tailed flycatcher. Beautiful bird.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Kelly.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. Give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. 8502. We did have Hill from Manny online, but we lost her. So, Hill, if you could, please call back. We go next to Samantha from Bloomberg, Texas. Samantha, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
Yes, I live on a farm in Bloomberg, and we have a dry creek. It goes, it's a seasonal creek.
Mm-hmm.
And our neighbor has a small pond, and there is a large blue-gray bird that just flies back and forth between the two. Is that a heron?
Yeah, but let me ask you something. I know a good bit of Texas, but I don't know where the heck Bloomberg is. What county are you in?
Cass County.
Okay, you're up in northeast Texas then.
Yeah,
great.
We're about 15 miles south. Well, we're 7 miles from the point where Arkansas, Louisiana, and Texas meet.
Okay, good.
Deep in the Arklatex.
Yeah, yeah. So I've never heard of Bloomberg, so that's a new one for me. But yeah, that sounds like a great blue heron. They're big, tall, and grayish. They're not very blue. They're maybe blue-gray when the light hits it, but they're large, and they will go from pond to pond, especially if they get flushed because somebody's scared them. And so they're...
Well, I've never seen another one. There's just one bird.
Yeah, and yeah, they nest in the listening area, so including in Cass County, they nest in... they're kind of exclusive heronries of just great blue herons. And I've seen, I don't know, a half dozen or more. Well, probably a full dozen. They're not in big numbers, maybe 10 or 20 pairs. But so he or she's got a spouse, I can assure you, because great blue herons are doing quite well. And we have quite a few of them. So he might look single, but it could be that, you know, it's that time of the year where they're not really paired up. A lot of birds don't pair up for life. And even those that do, that you don't always see them side by side, you know, shoulder to shoulder too.
Yeah.
So, but
well,
no.
We've been watching this one for about 3 years.
Okay.
And literally every day he goes back and forth. He flies from the pond to the creek, and from our house we can see both.
And you know what's interesting? You said you've seen them 3 or 4 years now. Without uniquely marking that bird, there is no way to know if that's really Bob, because it could be.
Don't tell them. My kids love that bird. They named him.
Did they make it a male or a female?
They're boys. They made it a male.
Okay, of course. Yeah, boys make them boys. But so Bob is right. So we'll just stick with that. His name is Bob, and he's the great blue heron. How about that?
Now, I have one other question. Okay. We had a mating pair of hawks on our property.
Uh-huh.
And we raised chickens, and our neighbors were like, you need to shoot them because of your chickens. But these I've never had a chicken die from a hawk.
Yeah, it's tough for free-ranging chickens because it makes all the predators excited. Foxes are a big problem. Bobcats. I mean, there's just everything that loves the taste of chicken. Me too. But it's illegal to shoot hawks.
Well, that's what I thought
yeah,
it was.
And we mentioned...
But we've never lost one.
That's good. So what I'd recommend is if you have a problem with a pesky hawk, try to get the chickens in the coop where they stay overnight. Some people have roaming cages where it might take a tractor to move it. And they'll move it every few days across their field. Or on the edge of the woods, and the chickens will have a new place to forage. You know, it might be the size of a small bathroom or bedroom, even of a cage. But that's one way to do it for people that have problems. Because let me tell you what happens if we shoot all the hawks. They're migratory, so you might shoot Bob the hawk, and guess what? Rick is waiting. He's coming in. His plane is landing soon. And if you shoot Rick, here comes Sally. She's got the next flight at 2:15, so she's coming in. It never ends.
I just didn't see the point in shooting
exactly.
them because they've never bothered the chickens.
Right.
Could it be because of the turkeys? I have turkeys in with my chickens.
I don't know if
they're so big?
Yeah, the turkeys are pretty tough. They're pretty rowdy when they see predators. Boy, I've seen some interesting interactions of turkey with white-tailed deer. I mean, they're just brutal. If a white-tailed deer gets too close, and the deer is just monstrous compared to the turkey, but the turkey's got such attitude and big spirit and is feisty. I don't know. That might be the reason, or you might have plenty of other things in the area that the hawk is feasting on. And like we mentioned last episode, those hawks are good neighbors to have. They're eating the rodents. The rodents are coming into the chicken coop. They can eat the eggs. They can steal the food. And some of those rodents can even, you know, catch and kill young chickens. So I would vote for the hawk. I'm glad you stuck up for the hawks. I would go back to that neighbor and explain that that's an illegal activity, and it's not sustainable. You know, like I mentioned, with all these birds migrating through, you just can't conquer that if that's what your mindset is. So talk to your neighbor and get them up to speed. And I'm glad you're on top of things, Samantha. Thanks so much. And,
I appreciate it.
Good to know about Bluebird, Texas. Thank you.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question regarding our avian world and the birds that live in it? And we go next to Hill from Manny. Hill got back online. How are you doing tonight, and what's your question?
I'm doing fine. My question is not so much about a species, but about a technique. You ask us to send you a picture of a bird we can't identify.
Okay.
Can you give any thoughts or comments about the telephoto lenses for cell phones by way of getting bird pictures?
I do a little bit of what's called digiscoping, where I have a spotting scope that I use to see birds at a distance, like out on a body of water, out on the shore, and you can stick your cell phone up to that and use it. So it's a digital camera against a scope. Digiscoping is where that word comes from. But no, I'm not a techno geek on what you're talking about. Actually, I've never even seen a lens that goes to a cell phone, but I've seen plenty of people doing the digiscoping, and it works really well because you're using the scope to look, and you might go through hundreds of birds and all of a sudden you see something unusual that you want to document, and you can just stick your phone up, and that's really worked well. I've seen some people do it so well that it's almost magazine cover quality, which is amazing.
Wow.
So maybe look that route if you want, but I can't answer anything about telephoto lens. I just don't know.
I wonder if Audubon magazine might have anything in it.
Yeah, I don't know that. You know, there's probably plenty of younger birders, 21-year-olds that have looked into this, but I guess I'm an old timer.
Yeah, they're good. They advertise clip-on telephoto lenses. You clip a telephoto lens on your cell phone.
Yeah, so I don't
see the picture on your phone. So.
That's interesting. Well, I don't know. What is the price for something like that?
If somewhere between $20 and $40, something like that.
Oh, okay. Well, that's a lot cheaper than if you're digiscoping. I mean, most of us have a cell phone, but if you're going to buy a scope, you're looking at $300 minimum and up. Yeah. I mean, $2,000 is not unusual for a really high-quality scope. So
I saw a number of them between $20 and $50.
Well, Hill, I would be interested, you know, if you were able to buy that and try it out and call us back in a few months. I would be interested to hear about it because I don't know anything about it.
We'd like to actually see some pictures and see how they come out.
Yeah.
Amazon, clip-on cell phone lens.
Okay, I'll look that up. And then if you can, he'll get some pictures and, like Bill said, submit it to us so we can see it and also share it with others. I think that would be really cool to see what it looks like with a bird picture.
Great. Okay,
yeah.
Thanks.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. We still have time for one more call or two more. Right now, Cliff, it is the migratory season, as most of us know. So for folks who are kind of on that path and want to be friendly to the birds, what is it that they can and probably shouldn't do at this time of year?
Well, I think the first thing to do is get outside and see what's out there. And there was a bit of a wind change today. If you noticed here in the listening area, the wind's shifted out and now we're out of the north-northwest and the humidity's dropped. Kind of a dry front, and I think there are going to be some birds following this front. This is the time of year where we get, kinglets are going to be pushing in. That's ruby crown mostly. We do get golden crowns, but yellow-bellied sapsucker, which I haven't seen one yet. This is about my first day. October 10, 12 is when I usually see one, but I know they come in earlier than that. I'm just not out and about to look for them. But I think getting outside is really important, and I've mentioned this in many of the episodes, is to custom make your backyard for wildlife, what we call a wildscape. And you can Google that term. Our department, Texas Parks and Wildlife, has a really good website that can help you figure out how to do wildscape, but basically it's landscaping for wildlife, because we all grew up thinking all you do is put out a bowl of food, maybe some water, but there's more to it than that. You're trying to provide cover. You're trying to provide natives that give back, that might have native berries, for example. They have nectar that they're giving to the butterflies and the hummingbirds. So I think that would be my message, is get outside and look, and also make sure your yard is beefed up in it. And that's not a thing you do on a two-day weekend. You need to kind of think of the wildscape as a work in progress, and you need a minimum of two or three growing seasons before you really see it in a good stage for birds.
We have time for one more quick caller. And Sam, you are online with Cliff. What's your question? Quickly, please.
It's about hummingbirds. Where do they migrate to? I was told that they migrate to one island off the mainland of Mexico. Is that true?
No. Most of our ruby throats are wintering in central and southern Mexico and points farther south. They start thinning out in Costa Rica. There are very few records in Panama. So really it's going to be central Mexico and south to about Costa Rica. So, okay, but all of them on one island, no, that's bogus.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thank you,
Sam. Thank you, Sam. And it's time to close out this week with our conservation tip. Cliff, what do you have for us?
Yeah, we're going to tie this into the duo of vultures that we profiled earlier, and this one is on scavengers. So scavengers are often the Rodney Dangerfields of the animal world in that they don't get much respect. Many people don't appreciate the role that scavengers have around us. We think it's yucky and gross, but without them, we'd be overrun with carrion, which is another name for a carcass. In the bird world, consider how both black and turkey vultures, the duo we profiled at the beginning of this episode, keep our roadways, fields, and lake edges clean of rotting dead animals. Vultures are sometimes the victim of guilt by association. Just because a rancher in his pasture comes across recently dead livestock, like a newborn calf, and it's surrounded by vultures, doesn't mean the vultures killed the animal. If the rancher didn't witness the entire event, this should be considered an unreliable eyewitness account. Instead, the vultures got there fast, and they're nature's cleanup crew. Respect the role that scavengers have in our environment. Many fear that vultures spread disease. On the contrary, by minimizing dead animals on the landscape, vultures help reduce the spread of bacteria and diseases like rabies, anthrax, botulism, cholera, and others. Allow birds like vultures to fulfill their role in nature. Remember that these birds are working for us. They're working for free. Respect for all native species around us, including scavengers like vultures, can go a long way. Do it for the birds.
All right, Cliff, thank you so much for joining us once again for Bird Calls
Great.
This week.
Thanks, Bill.
You have been listening to Bird Calls with Cliff Shackelford, our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio and a statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. We want to thank everybody at the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department for their help in creating this show, and I personally want to thank Cliff tonight for lending us his expertise. Bird Calls is made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. The producer of this program is Bill Beckett, with help tonight, and Cliff Shackelford, with help tonight from Wally Derleth, Henry Edwards, and Tim Schnell. The audio for tonight's program will be up on our website in a couple of hours at redriverradio.org. Stay tuned. Radio Lab is next here on Red River Radio, and next Tuesday, October 17th, will be the next edition of What's Bugging You. This is Red River Radio, and we are your community-supported public broadcasting service of LSUS. We are KDAQ, Shreveport-Bossier City, KLSA Alexandria Pineville, KBSA El Dorado Magnolia, and KLD in Lufkin, Nacogdoches. Again, stay tuned. Coming up next is Radio Lab, followed by the Acoustic Music Hour with Wally Derleth.